right, so we're at Mixo 8 now, and we're with some JavaScript gurus, and we want, go ahead and introduce yourself.
I think of myself more as a Mahatma.
Mahatma.
I'm Doug Crockford of Yahoo.
All right.
I'm Alex Russell of Dojo.
And I'm Joseph Smar from Plaxo.
Excellent. So one of the things we've been focusing a lot on Channel 9 since it's a developer community are programming languages. And so I wanted to talk a little bit today about JavaScript as a programming language. You know, doesn't seem to have evolved much, you know, for the past 10 years. I know there's a lot of very interesting things going on, and I'd like to get your perspectives on the language JavaScript. Let's start with you.
It's certainly evolved a lot in terms of how much people are trying to use it as a real language, you know? I mean, I think we were sort of talking before about, like, in the early days, JavaScript was sort of like, oh, yeah, you can add up the tax on your shopping cart, and but it was sort of just this little thing. And then people started realizing, wow, you can actually build these really rich applications about it. And certainly in the Ajax world, right, we all started really trying to push the envelope of what JavaScript could do. And it's this, you know, surprisingly flexible and open language because of the way it was designed that we've been able to sort of hack our way into these very, very sophisticated sets of programs, even though it seems like it's just such very simple building blocks. And so I think that's it's sort of been interesting how now there's this sort of evolutionary feedback of sort of, well, what do we need to do to grow the language? What do we need to add tools? But it's because people have realized, you know, the web is this great platform, and this language was actually far more powerful and flexible than we thought. And so we're all now thinking about it, I think, in a very different way. But I mean, for me, it's like JavaScript is the main language I program in, right? I really think of it that way now.
Interesting.
I totally agree that the usage of the language has changed a lot more than the language itself has, in part because we hadn't been to the edge of what HTML and CSS could get us, and the primary use case for JavaScript had always been on the client side. So, you know, when HTML and CSS kind of became well understood and we got to the edge of that evolution, we needed something to push us further, and I think JavaScript has really only taken off when it had to fill that goal, when it got pressed into service for that. So,
interesting.
And the language really hasn't been evolving at all. Right. The current specification was published in 1999, mm-hmm. and it's not changed since then. So in terms of evolution, it's been pretty steady. And that's actually been a big advantage. Having the language be stable, I think, was one of the factors that allowed Ajax to happen. Had it been in flux, the instability would have made Ajax a much more difficult thing.
Certainly. So let's talk a little bit about, I mean, there's a lot of imperfections that could be addressed. I mean, we could talk about maybe security concerns of the language, performance.
The language is hugely flawed. There are blunders. There are lots of blunders in the language, which had a lot to do with the early opinions of the language as being incompetent and not a real language and all of that. And those problems are real, but they are for the most part avoidable, except for one. And that is the security problem, which it's not particularly worse than any other language, but because it's the language in the browser, the security problem is really significant. So in the browser, we suffer from XSS attacks, cross-site scripting, which is a direct consequence of the design of the DOM and the design of JavaScript itself. And everything we do, all applications, are potentially at risk of being completely compromised because of this design error. And we cannot fix it without breaking backward compatibility. So it's a really difficult problem.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a great segue into the next one. I mean, if you guys are actively trying to evolve the language into, the next version of ECMA? You want to talk about, I mean, I know it's a can of worms, but...
But
the compatibility thing is a very interesting question, because there's 100 million lines of JavaScript out there,
To give you some historical context, in 2000, it was recognized that JavaScript was not very popular, wasn't getting picked up. Some people at Netscape and at Microsoft started thinking about a new edition of the language to try to make it more popular. They're going to essentially make it more Java-like, add classes to it and make it more conventional. But what's happened since then is that Ajax has happened and JavaScript got a second chance. And as a result of Ajax, and because of its privileged position in the browser, JavaScript is now the world's most popular programming language. I think we're writing more JavaScript than anything else. There are more JavaScript language processors deployed on more computers than any other language. It won. I mean, it made it. So the idea that we need to add a few more features in order to push it over the top, I think at this point is kind of silly. It's solving a problem that we haven't had You know, it's trying to solve an 8-year-old problem. It's no longer current.
You know, I would just add to that that, you know, while, you know, you can talk about security and stuff, it's really important to remember that, like, JavaScript is this amazing language that we've been able to get as far as we have with it is a real testament to the design of it. I mean, you know, it looks like Java, but that's just an artifact of, you know, the way Sun and all those people did this deal together. But it's fundamentally more like Lisp or Scheme, right? You've got this open, extensible prototype language with closures, it's, you can do these just incredible ninja moves in JavaScript that you just can hardly ever do in any other language. And the fact that that's living inside a web browser is the only reason why we can make all these things happen. And the fact that, you know, guys like Alex can write these compatibility layers that actually fill in the missing pieces, right? Like, you just can't go and actually fix the machine from inside with many languages the way you can with JavaScript. So whatever, you know, people talk about, oh, add this or add that or whatever, but the fundamental character that's made everything else possible was that kind of prime thing of you could actually modify the language itself. And, you know, that's where some of the security things come from, but, you know, really important not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because we didn't predict Ajax and all this other stuff with the way it was designed, but by being smart enough to leave it that flexible, the future generations could figure out the problems and the solutions, and we didn't have to wait for revving the browser or whatever, right? So it's like, that's actually a pretty amazing thing that hasn't happened a lot elsewhere in software, right?
Yeah, and I think as we talk about evolving the language, there's kind of two separate but related issues. You know, Doug, you mentioned that the ECMAScript 3 version was published in 99, and the stewardship of the prevalent implementation of JavaScript hasn't evolved, functionally speaking, since then. So, I mean, Microsoft's stewardship of their position with the JScript, with respect to the JScript engine, has been rather poor. Mm-hmm. And as a result, there's huge back pressure to get small fixes, incremental fixes, things which everyone else is doing right, into the language as is widely deployed. And then there's a related question about where do we go from here? And I think that, like, there's because there's only, you know, one process really for revving the language, which is get deployment. questions about how that's going to work out in the spec groups, how that's going to work out in the various implementations, have kind of a strange flavor to them, where people want to make large changes, people want to make big changes to what everyone is using, but there's always going to be this middle ground, this place where we're behind what people want to do with the language. And so getting a process in place where incremental improvements to it can be distributed and tested in the market before we wind up with a huge spec that does something seems to be useful. But I don't think that should necessarily keep us back from the idea of a better language, mm-hmm, that addresses some of the fundamental security concerns, addresses the grouping of code loading, that addresses structuring of code, typing, classes. Those are all things that should be on the table, but there's got to be a way to decouple these processes about fixing the deployed versions of what we're already using versus introducing new things. And I don't know that we've got a good solution yet.
Absolutely. Well, that's sort of a classic in programming language evolution, right? So when you do C# 3.0, for example, you don't make a ton of changes and break everyone because you wanted to add features. You add value and preserve what was, you know, is already out there. So there's certainly things that could be done that wouldn't break everyone if you had a better garbage collector, for example.
The thing that's different about programming in the web than any other environment is the programmer doesn't get to choose his language. You know, if you're doing something in a server or an embedded system or a client application, you get to choose what language and what version of that language, and perhaps even what vendor of that version of that language. In the browser, we don't get to choose. The user chooses, and usually it's an uninformed decision. And so we have to be able to deal with everything. We have to run with every possible implementation, and you can be confident that there will not be sufficient commonality over all of those versions and brands. And so that's the thing that historically has made browser programming especially difficult. Given that, JavaScript, maybe because of the simplicity of the language, has actually managed that pretty well. I don't know if you remember the Java era. That was one language from one vendor, and they couldn't get run everywhere right. Mm-hmm. Run everywhere is really, really hard, and run everywhere forever is even harder. Mm-hmm. And JavaScript didn't get it perfect, but it's doing pretty good, well enough that the web is now a viable programming application environment.
Absolutely.
Kind of along the same lines, so there are languages which which you know there's going to be progress in, right? You know that there's going to be a future in which the next version of Python is out, right? You're going to get Python 2.6 and 2.7 and Python 3000, and you're going to get them once every 6 months, once every 12 months. You know what that release cycle looks like. Folks who are doing JavaScript in a browser say, okay, we're going to get a new browser, and then it's going to be 4 years before I can use any features, which all of the browsers are going to deploy, because that's the uptake cycle from when all of them deploy out. So we have to have small things which add a lot of power, and we have to have those bug fixes eventually, because we have to be able to cycle that old bad stuff out of circulation. But it's hard, and we have to know that there's progress. And right now, it's looking good. Like, the IE8 announcement is huge. Looks like we're going to get progress. We don't know what's beyond that. Microsoft won't commit, as far as we can tell.
I'm afraid we can't talk about that right now.
No, absolutely. But, no, it's just sort of going on with sort of what makes JavaScript, this environment, special. It's like, you also can't ship the runtime with your product, right? So with a lot of these things, it's like, oh, I'm going to use this new cool version of .NET, and I'll just make my customers install it at the time. But with JavaScript, it's like, oh, well, you know, IE8 is out, and it's got this great new feature, but, okay, well, only 5% of my users are on IE8 because it hasn't, you know, been deployed yet. Well, it's like, now I can't use it until, you know, everybody, enough people have it, right? So that's even that further barrier. And the other thing, I mean, you mentioned garbage collecting. Actually, the thing to me that is the most unique about the JavaScript web environment is that you're starting from source code on every runtime, right? So, you know, it's not like a compiled language, and it's not even like, you know, PHP or Python, where the first time you use it, it gets compiled, and that gets cached, and you're just sort of running object code, right? You're actually reading the source code off of disk and interpreting it through every time. And so, that's something I had to learn the hard way at Plaxo, that when you think about how you architect a large JavaScript product, and all those things you were taught as a software engineer about abstractions and interfaces and getters and setters and all that, like, you're actually paying a cost for every line of source code that you put in there. And so you actually have to unlearn a lot of those programming methodologies that you learn, because, you know, the cost trade-off is just very different than in any other language. I can't think of another example where that's really how you have to learn to prove it. So you just have to learn how to be as terse and to the point, you know, and every line has to earn its place. You know, it's sort of a funny model like that. And, you know, then you can't choose it, and then it has to ship, you can't ship the runtime. And so, I mean, sometimes people ask us, like, you know, why are you guys such masochists, right? You're in this weird environment. But it's because, you know, That's the game, right? Everybody's got a web browser. It's this amazing place where I can ship an app that millions of people can use tomorrow, and I can fix it tomorrow if I want to tweak it.
Everybody will get it.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's like, and we're not as masochistic as the mobile programmer. So, you know, there's a whole spectrum of sort of how ubiquitous is something and what is the platform you have to play with. But that's why, at least for me, it's very exciting. Like, I think as programmers out in the field, you just assume that the web browser is this sort of unchanging black box, and, you know, we try our best to hack around its limitations and sort of make it work. But it's actually pretty neat now to be talking with the IE team here, talking with the Mozilla guys, and realizing these are, you know, fellow geeks like us that want to make things better and want to work on things. And so I don't know, at least I'm feeling a renewed sense of hope that, you know, the world may not be as static as we originally thought.
Outstanding.
That's one of those hard things about a browser too, is that you wind up with a scenario where you think that it's never going to get better because it's going to take 3 or 4 years, and then 3 or 4 years later, you wake up and you're like, wow, it's better. You know, you almost, in the meantime, forget all that good stuff that was coming down the wire, and then you pull up MSDN and you're like, I can use that? Holy crap, that's awesome. And there's not a lot of other environments where the lag between getting excited and getting to use it is so long that it actually takes people who've been embedded in that process of building stuff inside of a browser for a very long time to use it effectively, which is a huge disadvantage to the platform right now. Like, anything we can do to rev the web faster would be awesome.
Right, and the compensating advantage is that your application can potentially reach a billion people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you got some pain on the development side versus that reach of audience, and it's
and
a good trade-off.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, but that certainly brings up a good point. I mean, how do you change that model? I mean, it's clearly you'd like that model to change. And so you could argue that with the addition of new programming models, say Silverlight or Java or things like that, where you have sort of the traditional sort of programming experience that you're used to from a typed system, classes, et cetera, debugging, blah, 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 powerful garbage collection, et cetera. So really what I'm trying to spit out is, how do you guys feel that the interoperability between the old school JavaScript that you're talking about with lots of reach and its greatness versus the new school, where you've really added real programming, and I shouldn't say real programming, but, you know, the general purpose programming stuff that most people are used to using,
at least if you're a general purpose developer. How do you feel with that?
They should learn JavaScript.
Well, okay, that's your answer.
Well, that's a possible outcome, that a proprietary system like Silverlight or Flash or, you know, some other thing, Java perhaps even, would displace JavaScript and the DOM. And there are lots of good reasons to consider that, because they'll be much more modern. I mean, the browser is now, what, 15 years old, and it wasn't state-of-the-art when it was introduced, and it has not aged well. So there's a whole lot of stuff that we'd like to be able to do presentationally, which we cannot do. And it's hard to see how we push that forward. But it's open, and, you know, so right now we're looking at what can we do to fix the open system. And some of the things we're looking at are expedient, like a subset of JavaScript to deal with security in mashups and similar sorts of applications. Google's doing some interesting work with Caja and Cajita, which are a subset of JavaScript. I have a subset called AdSafe. They're all pretty similar in that if guest code goes through either of those processes, then it's a verifiable subset of JavaScript, which in theory is safe to interact with other code. So that is a partial solution to the XSS problem. And we can do that today. It's not a good long-term solution, because eventually I expect the attackers will cause it to erode, and we'll be
all over.
It'll be bad. But that can allow us to make some distance on the mashup problem today in anticipation of better fixes in the future.
Excellent.
So that's another really good point about sort of what makes the whole JavaScript world special is this whole mashup phenomenon, where you want random other code to be able to run side by side of your code and have them not conflict and not be insecure. And that's not normally when you're writing a, you know, Java program or a C# program or whatever. In most cases, it's in a controlled environment. You write all the code, and so it's just a matter of sort of how productive can you be, right? But the whole thing about the way, especially the way the web is evolving, is, you know, you want to be able to drop your Google map inside your page, or you want to be able to, you know, have your different open social gadgets interacting with the page, and you know, you want it, so you want it to be sort of promiscuous but safe, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's this very different kind of set of trade-offs that you're trying to make, you know. And that's another thing. It's just a very unique set of design constraints. So it's like, I think hopefully what you hear us saying is not like, oh, how do we fix the web, meaning how do we get strong typing and all this other stuff. What we're really saying is, how do you keep that flexibility, and how do you keep that ability to sort of do all the amazing things that we've come up with, but how do you make it so that, you know, we're not waiting another 15 years for the next set of problems, right? And as far as we've done, you know, hacking the system to make it do things it was never designed to do, I do think we all feel like we're starting to hit up against the walls, and we don't have another 5 years of clever hacks that's going to take and then 25-year-old technology and make it super modern, right? So at some point, the platform really does need to evolve, and I think we're all amazed we've gotten as far as we have.
It is. It truly is amazing.
There's a couple of game changers that could be deployed with the current state of affairs. So it's not a given that we always have to go back to the wire for every resource, right? This is just an artifact of browser implementations. And because we don't have the ability to pull and then store libraries, you know, share libraries across sites, that kind of thing, in an effective way without kind of running afoul of the browser's caching mechanism, we always have that constraint where you have to go to the wire to get the stuff you need, or assume that you're going to go to the wire to get the stuff you need. So if the browser vendors were to be able to put in some sort of a caching mechanism for commonly used code, or a way to share code so that it could be, you know, treated as commonly used over time, or market as commonly used such that it had preferential caching, we could definitely change not just the state of affairs for how you write stuff in the language. That's probably going to take language changes to build a more structured language. But certainly the way you use it in a deployed environment, that's got real legs. Things like performance improvements to the browser engines themselves, GC fixes, the string stuff that we're seeing in IE8 looks great. I can't wait to actually kick the tires on a lot of the new performance improvements there. Yeah, the selector stuff. Mm-hmm. Stuff that happens around those which don't have direct API impacts, and which the code can adopt to, can get us a transition to a substantially better performing web with essentially the same constituent pieces without wholesale change to all of the parts. And it's worth noting that Silverlight has a lot of the same liabilities in play, right? If I go and I grab a Silverlight XAML file, maybe it comes down zip, maybe it doesn't. It's got to go get resources from the wire too. How is it going to manage that cache? It's interpreted as well. It's all coming down as a document. It's all got to be interpreted script. We don't get a get out of jail free card by moving to to another platform unless it's something like Flash where you can compile it down to a single piece of bytecode. But then you lose all the advantages of being open. And then Silverlight made these architectural choices to be like the web for great reasons. It lets people get going faster. It allows them to write in languages that they know. It's open. It's substantially more open in terms of doing text processing, which is what most of the service side is doing anyway these days. Mm-hmm. So those evolutionary advantages just need some complementary evolution on the side of their host environments. And Silverlight can do it, and IE can do it, and everyone else should do it. And when we get those, we'll be in a better place.
Cool. I mean, one of the things is when you think about how much code is out there. So I worked on Windows Update back, you know, a long time ago, and there's a lot of JScript that was written, JavaScript. And the thing that was interesting was that when you had multiple developers working on these projects, as you were talking about earlier, the actual design, it was hard to kind of understand what people were doing necessarily, which is much easier in a more structured language. So how does that work with big development teams and lots of JavaScript? What are some of your tips and tricks and whatever advice you can give to people?
So I work on Dojo, which is a JavaScript toolkit, and we have a code loading system. So we have a package system that lets you structure your code in kind of a sane way and load things on demand, optimize it for deployment, that kind of thing. So that's a reasonable solution as a stopgap. There are more aggressive solutions, things like GWT or Nihil's C-Script.
Script Sharp.
Yeah, Script Sharp.
Or Volta has an interesting solution.
Volta too. So there are ways of kind of finessing that problem. But if you're going to stick to regular JScript and not some other language that goes down to it, you have to put a lot of structure into your team today or come up with tools that are going to allow you to easily structure, make that the default way of doing things.
I ran a team that we did this very ambitious set of Ajax apps for Plexus, or address book and calendar, and very rich. And it was the same thing where you really had to kind of develop a lot of methodology because JavaScript itself is so open to really do our own structuring of how things are set up and how they talk to each other and how the code is documented and all that. And not to mention building our own internal, sort of logging frameworks and messaging and all that. So you have to build a lot of those pieces because they're not there. But the solution was not to go make it all look like Java code. I think it's something that actually Doug's spoken eloquently about too, that learning the kind of zen of the language that you're in and learning how to make good JavaScript code is not about shoehorning it into some other framework that you're used to. It's about learning how to write good code in that environment. And actually, there's a lot of great things you can do in that environment that you can't do in these sort of more structured languages, and that can actually make the programs a lot more expressive and a lot more simple. But you sort of have to take it on its own terms. And it's the same thing if you come to, Python or Lisp or one of these other things. You're sort of tempted to make it work the way you're used to. And in fact, because JavaScript's so flexible, you can almost get away with it. You can almost pretend that you're doing classical object inheritance and all that kind of stuff. And that's all the more reason why you have to stop and realize, just because I can make it bend doesn't mean I want to be fighting uphill the whole way. And once I sort of realize sort of the true zen of the language, you can actually, do really great things.
Outstanding. So, what is the true zen of the language?
Working with the grain, understanding how functions work, that's probably the key thing, that functions are first class and lexically scoped, and amazing power is derived from that. Yeah, you have closures. You have dynamic objects, and dynamic objects you can think about in radically different ways than in static object systems. And you put those two together, and that's the innovation of JavaScript, is putting those two ideas together in one language. That's where the power came from. That allowed us to fix basically the application platform. The DOM was not designed to be an application platform, but we need one. And so we made it one, by having libraries like Dojo, basically.
And
YUI. We go in and we fix it. And we fix it in place. And the language is powerful enough that we're able to do that. So the trick is to be able to do that. The difficulty is that the language doesn't demand that you be working at that level, which in a way is a good thing. JavaScript has the greatest dynamic range of any language ever written. You don't need to know anything about programming in order to write programs in JavaScript. You can cut and paste. We've got totally incompetent people who are making websites, and JavaScript will let them do that. Those people could never get something out of a Java compiler, but they can get stuff into a browser and make it run. Brilliant. At the same time, you've got people doing computer science at a very high level in the language and everything in between. I contend there's no other language that comes anywhere close to that range of usage. So the good thing about that is that there's something there for everybody. It's easy for beginners to get started. But it demands a lot of discipline on the part of the high-level developers to make sure that they keep working at the high level and keep clean. So some of the good practices that would be good in working with any language are especially necessary in working with JavaScript because the language can be sloppy. And so in my own code, I use JSLint all the time because it helps me to work with the professional subset of the language that I think is the sweet spot. I recommend code reviews in groups on at least a weekly basis, have everybody look at what everybody else is doing. That's good for any language, but I think it's especially good with JavaScript because you want to catch bad practice early.
Mm-hmm. So how are you guys debugging? Let's talk about the debugging experience for you guys, especially with Ajax.
Firebug. You write it in Firefox first, you use Firebug, and then you spend your day, week, month, whatever, porting to IE. That's the state of affairs.
Is that really how it is?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
In every team I've ever seen, that's how it is.
Yeah, we were just talking with the IE team about this. There's a lot of hope that can change in IE8 with the tools that they're adding. But, you know, it used to be, you know, I always tried to get my team to use IE because I said, well, hey, most of our users still use IE, so we want to make sure it looks good in IE. And for a while, you could kind of get away with that. But the environment is just literally night and day difference in Firefox with Firebug in particular in terms of the visibility you have, the ability to iterate. And so I just can't get my team and nor myself at this point to do anything other than what Alex just said. And it's a shame because, you know, I mean, we've tried to all be savvy about how to write code that is likely to work well in all the browsers. You know, you sort of have to figure it out. And it's a shame because there's no real, especially in box model and things like that, there's no real core that will work everywhere. So you really do have to learn how to do things more that should be simple in a more complicated way that will hopefully be less painful. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, it doesn't always work, and you have to, you know, I always have to train my guys to, like, go back and try it in IE. Did you try it in IE? What about this? Or, you know, and learn the kind of gotchas that won't just work. But it's just because of the asymmetry in the tools, right? I mean, everybody's sitting at their desk with their tools, and it's like, well, if I have visibility here and I don't have visibility here, what am I supposed to do? But like I say, the stuff in IE8 looks great, and these guys know Firebug, and, you know, so they're looking at it. So I look forward to a world where we can actually move back to saying you're primarily developing in IE, but, you know, it's a high bar.
It's worth noting that it used to be the other way around, right? So it used to be you wrote it in IE, and then you spent your Netscape day, right?
Absolutely. And that was my experience.
Yeah, yeah. And it's changed, right? The thing is flipped. There's always been someone on top, someone who's not.
Exactly.
And it's funny that in all of that time, it was always the minority market share browser that had better tools. So, you know, we've got great in IE6 and IE7, and even before, there was the Microsoft Script Editor, and you can do Visual Studio debugging. But getting people to do that when Firebug is so damn good is nigh impossible. I'm really excited about what looks like it's coming down the pike in IE8. Those debugging tools look really great. It's a good start.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk a little bit about performance. I know that's an issue. I know that you guys have tips and tricks, and you help people, and you have good little things to do this, don't do this. But in general, the notion of performance in today's state of the engine that does all the work, do you see that? Let's talk a little bit about that. I guess that's a question. Performance,
it's getting better,
JavaScript.
Right? I mean, so we've always been betting on Moore's Law. We're writing in an interpreted language that's shipping all of its code down the wire all of the time. Everyone who's ever written JavaScript is betting on Moore's Law to make it better without anything else. Because, we can't depend
on
Moore's
Law is over.
Well, we'll see, right? I mean, we're still getting faster and faster JavaScript interpreters. For us, we might have an echo effect. We'll see. And Moore's Law is not definitively over.
Well, not definitively, but, I mean, now we're in the age of many core, right? So if you have 80 cores, those engines are going to have to target them correctly.
Well, and absolutely. And so that's where things like Google Gears become incredibly important, where you wind up with the ability to say, I want to dish this workload off to that other process and then have it use an MPI interface to get back to me. And the fact that the browser vendors in general haven't picked that innovation up is distressing. But hopefully Gears will get wide distribution. We could do it with Silverlight if we knew that Silverlight was running out of process and we could throw JavaScript over to it. There are ways of doing this, right? We can do these things. We can do it with a JVM, right? We can fire up the JVM. Java 6 has Rhino built in. I can fire JavaScript over to it. There are ways of using the other cores that are around if we know that things are running out of process or can take advantage of that parallelism to offload some of that workload. But for the DOM, we just need better primitives in the browser.
Yeah, it's another one of those things to add to the list of what makes JavaScript special is we've never had real multi-threading. You know, you sort of have fake multi-threading, and in fact, you can get a long way with one of the big things we found out was for improving the perceived performance of the page, doing a lot of little set timeouts back to yourself with a 0 millisecond timeout becomes kind of like a yield, and so you can kind of start to do this, you know, almost like cooperative multitasking where you let the UI refresh a little bit in the middle, but you don't really have multi-threading. But in terms of performance, you know, one of the things I said in my high-performance JavaScript talks that people seem to remember is, let's not forget that blank web pages are really fast.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. You load it up and it's like, bam! You know, even on like kind of so-so hardware, like it's just super fast. Mm-hmm. And so, like, web apps are only slow if you let them get slow, right? And, you know, when we were first building all the Plaxo address book and calendar stuff, you know, we weren't really sensitive to that. We kind of threw all our best ideas in there. We had a ton of great creative ideas. And, you know, the thing totally fell over. It was just more than the browser could handle. And then we had to kind of dig our way out of the hole. And that's a hard thing to do. Mm. But now we have this discipline where you start fast and you just never let it get slow. Right? And it's more kind of the mentality that people who work on embedded systems have. You sort of have these budgets and you're just ruthless about it. And as long as you do that, you can ship really fast code, right? Mm-hmm. And you learn, you know, like if you look at the evolution of Dojo, right? They went back and almost rewrote the whole thing from this same perspective of how do you keep the code incredibly terse? How do you do the things that are fast and not the things that are slow? Rather than trying to bend the browser to your will, you go to the will of the browser. And when you follow those things, it gets part of that whole Zen thing, right? When you get into that mindset, then, you know, you can ship really great experiences.
Sure.
Yeah, one of the things that created a lot of excitement around Ajax was WoW, where people were doing silly things, you know, in the UI, and people going, "Wow, I didn't know a browser could do that." And for a while, we were seeing unnecessary WoW all over the place. But it turns out WoW costs, and so we're now finding that we have to use WoW really selectively. We can't put it in just because the programmer wants to show off or the designer was bored. It has to be there because it's necessary to serve the user. And particularly, we're starting to look at widget-based systems in which there might be 10 or 20 widgets all on one page, all running simultaneously. And if they're all going WoW, the thing's not going to work at all.
Absolutely.
This is also one of those places, and I work on a toolkit, so I'm obviously biased, but they're, you know, I think the majority of people who are using modern JavaScript are picking up Atlas or jQuery or Prototype or Scriptaculous or YUI or Dojo or something, right? They're picking up some toolkit to make their life easier, and those abstractions, there's an arms race inside those abstractions, right? Like, we make the Dojo query selector engine faster, jQuery makes theirs faster. Prototype makes theirs faster. You know, so that arms race. If you can find a good abstraction and start, you know, and leverage it in a lot of places, you can start to get a lot of advantage over time. So, like, we have an event connection system inside of Dojo for managing. It's an aspect-oriented programming system, and so with that, we can leverage that to make sure that we don't get memory leaks, we don't get garbage collection issues on IE or other places. So having a couple of those thin wrappers for things that you use all the time can really help you.
Let's talk about how you compose those wrappers.
Sure.
So I mean, you just written were they JavaScript classes? I mean, what kind of? Let's talk about the level at which you're implementing these innovations.
So a lot of them, like, we view them as features that the browser should have, but they don't already.
Okay. So
IE8 is implementing query selector all, which is an incredibly important API, which lets me say, if I'm a designer, I know CSS, right? I know how to say to the page, find me this set of nodes and do something with it. And so it lets you take that expressive capacity and take it to JavaScript and say, I kind of know how to get a set of things and then do something with them. And so all of the JavaScript toolkits have kind of had an implementation of that API for years now. And now the browsers are starting to pick it up, and now we can lean on them, and it'll get even faster. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of it. Like, you kind of bet on things that everyone needs for all their apps. A lot of that knowledge is abstracted from building lots of apps. Like, we've built lots of apps with Dojo. We built lots of apps on the previous toolkits I worked on. YUI is deployed to millions and millions of people every day worldwide. Like, that kind of reach teaches you a lot of lessons in a hurry. And so
I remember talking with, I think it was Scott Isaacs, the some of the initial DHTML stuff, you know, and they were saying, you know, at the time, people weren't building rich apps. So, you know, we sort of like took our best guess on how to like build this framework, and, you know, we got some stuff right and we got some stuff wrong, mm-hmm. but it was almost a shot in the dark in some ways, right? Whereas now we've had people really kicking the tires on the kind of stuff they want, and we've got a pretty clear roadmap. So, you know, that old analogy about, you know, you let people walk on the grass and then you pave the paths based on where they walked. I think that's kind of the situation that we've got now. Mm-hmm. And because JavaScript's so expressive, and you ask, like, how does that work? You know, you build a function that gives you the behavior you want, and either it's a function you call and you pass in the stuff you want, or you can modify the prototypes of the objects and make it look like they have these behaviors. But whatever it is you do, you enable that capability, and then you hope that at one day when someone calls that function, you know, the browser is handing it natively, because there's a lot of overhead when you're talking about the DOM, when you're talking about CSS. You're doing that up in JavaScript space is just very, very inefficient, right? And when you step through the C++ code underneath that, you realize, you know, how much work you're making it do to do some simple thing, right? Yeah. And the good news is there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, right? So it's like you can, you know, worst case, like for the query selector stuff, you can worst case iterate through every item and find which ones match, right? But obviously, guys under the hood can do a much better job of implementing that.
So. Absolutely. Great point. Because they'll be right, because it's happening at the machine level. Very nice. So are we always going to have JavaScript? Is it always going to be around?
I hope not. because of JavaScript security problems, as long as we have JavaScript, we will have XSS attacks, and it will not be safe to mash up. And we really want to mash up. Hmm. So at some point, we're going to have to make the hard transition away from JavaScript, hopefully to a very similar, almost compatible language, but not a compatible language, which will have much better security properties so that we can be free of XSS attacks and we can do mashups and have them safe. And I think the sorts of applications that come from that will be really, really interesting.
I'm not quite as down on the prospects of JavaScript as a language. I think for some value of always, it'll probably be true where always is longer than 10 years. I mean, that's as far as I care, right? So, okay. I mean, it's incredibly widely deployed. The upgrade cycles currently are measured in years, not in months. The entire deployed web needs JavaScript. So,
sure.
Yeah, it's forever.
And I think, you know, to go the other way, like, it's not just about JavaScript in the browser. I think a lot of people are excited about using JavaScript elsewhere because it's such a great language in so many ways. I mean, certainly, look at something like JSON, right? This way of representing data, which I think everyone, certainly that I know, you know, we're all using JSON on the server as our main interlingua because, you know, it's like XML without the crap, you know what I mean? It's like it just works great, every language supports it, and it's very expressive. And the fact that it happens to be native JavaScript, you know, is great because you can have the same APIs that are server-to-server APIs and server-to-client APIs, right? Mm-hmm. Clients have never been very good at XML and SOAP and that kind of stuff, right? So that's an area of JavaScript actually having a life beyond, you know, what it is in the browser. And, you know, for example, in Google's Social Graph API, there's this core part of it that's open source that helps you, does a lot of sort of pattern matching about different domains. So if you want to know, hey, is this Alex on Flickr? You know, he can represent that URL in a bunch of different ways, and it can match the same thing. Well, that's something that had to work in every language because it's got to be this component for the web. And Brad Fitzpatrick, who's the main guy who worked on it, he chose to write the core language all in JavaScript and then embed through SpiderMonkey and other things wrappers into, you know, C# and Java and PHP and all these other things. But again, that the engineering is all in JavaScript because it's so flexible and so iteratable and so forth. So I think you may see JavaScript showing up in other places that you wouldn't have thought before.
Interesting. And is the, you know, and will the language evolve?
I sure hope so. I mean, there's lots of movement on that.
From the language perspective, yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of movement on that now.
But there's also, because what I'm seeing out there is there's now the ActionScript debate that's going on with where you want to have a new JavaScript that shoots out bytecode at some point, right?
Can
we talk about that?
It's fundamentally incompatible with the nature of the web, which is that it's all text on the wire, yeah. Right? For better and for worse, text on the wire gets us a lot of advantages. And mm-hmm. So, I mean, you could have that alongside. I would assume that that the optimization that you'll see first is that browsers themselves will move to bytecode interpretation, or that they'll move to some other internal representation which can be cached, and so that when you re-request it, you're not going to be reparsing it. Maybe you'll be pulling it out of a parse tree cache or a bytecode cache. Those are low-hanging fruit where we don't have to change the fundamental nature of how we build what we're shipping in order to get the advantage.
Yeah, the language itself doesn't care if how it's transmitted. You know, it could be in text or it could be in bytecodes. It really doesn't care. bytecodes could make it faster, but there are probably other things we could do which would be more effective.
Mm-hmm. Like?
The Tamarin tracing VM is really interesting. It is a bytecode VM, but it points to a world where untyped code can run nearly as fast as typed code.
Yeah, one of the reasons why we have performance problems now is that all of the JavaScript engines were optimized for time to market. Mm. And that time was over 10 years ago. And they really haven't been revisited since. If anything, they've gotten cruftier since then.
Yeah.
So we've seen recent work on a new JScript engine, which looks really good. There's a Tamarin work that's being done at Adobe. We're starting to hear rumors of very high-performance JavaScript engines. We're going to get some speed out of it, so that's going to be really nice.
Absolutely. Cool. Well, hey, I'm going to do something a little bit stranger here, just because you guys introduced yourselves at the beginning of the interview, but we haven't really ever talked about, most of the people, web developers out there probably will know who you are, but for those who don't, let's talk a little bit about what you do. Like, what do you work on? What's your, besides your name and where you work, like, what are some of the things that you've developed and you're known for here in the JavaScript world?
I was one of the first people to recognize what JavaScript actually was. I discovered JSON, for example, in JavaScript. I discovered that JavaScript had lambdas in it, which was something prior to that date no one had been aware of.
Nice.
And you wrote a lot of the early work on inheritance and prototypal chaining inside of public, private, protected methods and styles and patterns for
JavaScript.
Fantastic. Yeah.
See, I'm glad I asked, right? Yeah. For
Doug
those
rocks.
Who don't know.
Doug really helped us understand what we had. I think that's the way it is. And all the stuff that we're talking about now about how it really works and what you really do, I mean, it was there, but because, like you said, the history was people hadn't been using it for that, it took someone to think deeply about the language and realize what we really had in our hands. And so that's been, I think, pretty foundational in all the work that we've done.
What do you do?
Oh, I just jumped around. Yeah. So I work at Plaxo, and we build these tools that help you stay connected to all the people you care about, and that includes being able to access and synchronize your address book and calendar information across Outlook and Mac and Thunderbird and Yahoo and Google and all these places, and access it on the web, which is obviously important. And because we sync people's real data, we get a lot of data. We have people's years of people's calendars and thousands of contacts in their address book. And so we've always had to do very Ajax-y kinds of things, even back, we've been around for 5 or 6 years, and so it was a lot of submitting dynamically generated JavaScript into iframes and things like that before there was real Ajax. And then in real Ajax, you can't deal with that much data, so you have to constantly be doing all these tricks about how do you load and cache just pieces of it as you're scrolling around and as you're typing in people's names and so forth. And so we've done a lot of kind of pushing the envelope there, and also figuring out a lot of stuff around how do you do cross-site scripting when you want, in a good way. So how do you do these sort of mashups where we built a little widget where you could look up your address book and pre-fill people's names. So if you wanted to invite people to a service or send a news article to them, and making it so that we could actually have that kind of drop-in experience with another site, even though the browser tries to prevent that, and figuring out kind of ways that people can cooperate and get around it. That's been another kind of fun part of the whole hackery, and the stuff we did was all built on Dojo. So that's where we started hanging out.
Very cool. Very cool.
I work for a company called SitePen. I work on the open source side almost exclusively. I do Dojo. I work on another project called Comet D. And I just try to make browsers do things they shouldn't. So that's my day job.
That's awesome. Well, hey, it's been great meeting you guys. And it'll be fun to see where JavaScript is in 5 years.
Or isn't.
And to see what's going on in engine world that's being developed by various companies.
Yeah, that'll
Should
be exciting.
Very interesting. Hey, thank you so much for your time, and thanks for coming to Mix.